and gentlemen, welcome this morning. I'm Steve Chaney, the CEO of American Security Project, and we're pleased that you're here to talk TTIP. And we're really pleased to have this distinguished panel, and with that, to chair our panel is Congressman Glenn Nunn.
Well, good morning. First of all, thanks to everybody for being here, and thank you to General Chaney for hosting us this morning. I also want to thank Paul Hamlin and all of the American Security Project staff for helping organize the event today. Let's jump right into it. We have an hour or so and a great topic, so I want to just kind of get things going. But let me take a moment to introduce our first speaker, and I'm going to ask each of the speakers to make some opening comments on their thoughts on the topic, and then we'll try to save some time for questions. So it is my pleasure to introduce Dan Grant this morning. Dan is someone whom I've had the pleasure of knowing for many years, going back to studying together at Georgetown, but I've also had the pleasure of being able to work with Dan in a number of foreign places, including Iraq and Afghanistan and the Balkans. Dan continues to work for the Foreign Service, for the State Department, and as a fellow here at the American Security Project. So let me just open it up to you, Dan, to give us some thoughts about the TTIP and lead us into a discussion about how this looks strategically.
Thank you, Glenn. This is a bit of an arcane subject because I can think of nothing that will stimulate the mind at this early hour than a discussion of transatlantic trade talks. So I'm grateful that everyone is willing to come here and be attentive. Thank you. This trade arrangement that has been proposed and is currently under negotiations between the EU and the United States has not gotten a great deal of attention in the press and hasn't caused much controversy. And for those in the audience that have been around long enough to remember, this stands in stark contrast to how things unfolded with NAFTA about 20 years ago. And the reasons are fairly straightforward. The trade barriers between the EU and the United States are already fairly low. The economies are roughly comparable to one another in terms of sophistication, in terms of legal protections, rule of law, transparency, that sort of thing. And so the removal of remaining tariffs, the harmonization of regulations between the two won't create as great a degree of shock between the two countries, and the benefits are great. The impulse that came about to conduct this free trade zone was born out of largely two reasons. One is the global recession has made it difficult for anybody to get forward traction outside of the standard methods of priming the pump economically through fiscal policy and cuts in interest rates and monetary policy. And so the reduction of barriers will produce a GDP boost of about 0.5% in Europe and 0.5% in the United States. And that's not nothing. It'll translate to several hundred dollars a year per the average American, or certainly American family. And then secondly, the World Trade Organization's latest round of talks in Doha had stalled, basically due to disagreements of standards between developed economies and developing economies. And it was hard to make the two parts see eye to eye and conclude the next round of negotiations. And as a result, Europe and the United States decided to figure out, well, we'll try to do something where we can come to an easy agreement. And so they have done. And by all indications, the trade agreement will proceed in round after round of negotiations over the next 2 to 3 years. It's projected that the negotiations themselves will conclude probably sometime in 2014, perhaps 2015, and then be presented to the respective bodies in the EU and in the Senate in the United States for ratification in 2016. And so the question then stands, well, if it's not particularly controversial, if there isn't a great deal of objection, not even from labor in the United States, which is interesting to note, they're in fact mildly supportive of it, then why is this particularly significant? And a reason why is this has an effect on China's role vis-a-vis the rest of the world. If a trade bloc of this size is created that has harmonized regulations, it's the regulatory power of it that really makes the difference, because it will comprise a bloc that'll be anywhere from 40 to 50% of the world's economy in terms of total GDP. And essentially, it'll create a gravitational pull on a lot of other countries in terms of what the standards for capitalistic activity will be and the prices to pay for not playing by the rules in terms of tariffs and exclusion and that sort of thing. And that isn't necessarily an intentional output, but it's a side effect that will benefit the United States and Europe, just because the power of the Chinese economy is undeniable, even if they're in the midst of some economic troubles of their own, the implications of it. Just given the size of the market, the potentiality that it has, it will be a competitor of no small note. And it's hard for any one individual economy to go head-to-head with China in terms of determining what the rules are. That is less the case when you have a block of this size. It would dwarf the Chinese economy, basically. And this has been noted by China as a result of the TTIP negotiations that are undergoing right now, which really hasn't been observed all that much in the United States because it's just a boring trade deal. But you are already seeing references being made to the TTIP in People's Daily, in Chinese media, and it varies from sober assessment of the facts of how, well, this is just how things are unfolding, where it's competition between states that isn't hostile towards concerns of a Cold War on the trade axis between the West and the East. And it need not be that. It's, to my mind, it's an opportunity for China as its economy is maturing and developing from an industrializing, fiscally oriented economy towards a consumer one, which is basically where the rest of developed economies are. It will start to have the pressure to have standards of its own anyway. And so it's a chance for China to come in and make common cause there. And anyway, that's the assessment that I have seen so far, and certainly it's one from the American perspective. There is a parallel trade agreement that's happening in Asia that the United States is also party to that, in order to improve confusion, is called a TPP, so that you can easily mix up the two and make other people look at you even more blankly than you were before. And it is likely that if the European and American trade deal is reached and agreed to, the Asian one will also probably accelerate. And you'll have two large trade blocks on either side of China to which it is not a party. That's basically my assessment of things. I would love to hear my European colleagues.
Jeffrey Harris, you're the deputy head of the European Parliament Liaison Office with the U.S. Congress. So you have a particularly interesting view of the dynamic between the European parliamentary system and the American congressional system, and have served as a staff member to the European Parliament on many issues, including development and external trade. So give us the view from Europe, as it were.
Well, good morning, everybody. Just by way of introduction, I should say that I'm an official of a parliament. Made up of 700 or so independent-minded people, but differently from the United States, a much wider range of opinions. So what I'm going to try and say are occasionally my personal reflections and occasionally the reflections of the institution that I work for. Just to say how I approach the subject, I consider that the TTIP is a potentially win-win arrangement for the transatlantic partners, and that if China approaches, or encouraged to approach, or decides to approach this very important developing agreement in a positive spirit, then it could be a win-win-win form of global economic interdependence. But anyway, just to wake you up, we'll start with a little bit of Aristotle. Who said that politics is civil war pursued by other means. And of course, Erwin Seltzer, an equally great intellectual, apparently said that trade is politics and war pursued by other means. I say that by way of introduction to a basic reminder of what the European integration process is all about, because in the year that I've lived here in the US, I have noticed from time to time a little bit of skepticism. I don't mean Euroscepticism, British style, but some doubts as to whether this process is durable. But actually, the European integration process both in the 1940s and particularly in the 1990s, has been a vast peace process. Peaceful integration, conflict resolution, as we call it in academic circles, but basically within the territory of the 28-member European Union, we have an irreversible, fairly successful, peaceful process, prosperous, certainly relatively, many economic problems. We have a crisis in the management of the euro, which is certainly challenging, but doesn't mean that the whole edifice is about to collapse. Indeed, it's worth looking at the era in which the euro was born and comparing the trajectory of Europe and China. Because of course, the euro was born as part of the post-1989 reinforcement of the integration process, a process which the United States had given its blessing to from the 1940s, although from time to time these waves of skepticism have been apparent. A famous article about whether the euro would lead to war, it's an old one, let alone the more recent articles I've read since I've come here. But of course, the transatlantic security partnership was of fundamental importance, although now with the wider, larger European Union encompassing areas which were occupied or controlled by the USSR, the concept of the umbrella is not quite what it was. China in 1989 also responded to the changes in Europe. I've always thought that the visit of Gorbachev just before Tiananmen and how these different events unfolded in Europe and China were not totally separate processes. China in 1989 set out, after the repression of Tiananmen, set out on a new trajectory. It has produced an enormous amount of political success, but be very summary here. I think it is still producing a rather stagnant political system, but that is something perhaps we can discuss. The Chinese have always supported the process of European integration, indeed encouraged it, compared, for example, with the USSR, which was always encouraging people in Europe to be against the whole process and was always waiting for it to collapse. But the Chinese have always supported the integration process. Maybe there's some doubts now, precisely because China has invested so much in the euro. But the interdependence between China and the Western economies has probably gone too far to be reversed. And certainly the idea Khrushchev announced, "We will bury you," that kind of language is not only inappropriate, one might say politely, but just irrelevant given the nature of the modern economy. So I mean, that's how I look at this triangle of economic relations and the security aspects. As you were saying, China is perhaps a little perplexed and concerned by the development of both the TTIP and the TPP. Yes, the European Union and the United States are coming together as part of a jobs and growth revival operation, but also to establish standards for the world economy. So I would see this, yes, as a challenge to China, but not in any way an attack. I do read articles about economic NATO, or even the great Brzezinski, who I respect a great deal, announcing that the TTIP will somehow end the decline of the West. What he said apparently in Bratislava one day. I think that kind of language can be misunderstood by recipients hearing it over there in Asia. So China should not perceive these developments as some kind of attack. But it's a test, of course, for China how it decides to respond. China likes to see itself as the sort of spokesman, leader of the developing world. On the other hand, can it, it present itself as the standard bearer of low standards, if I put it in a simple way? That may be not a very appealing long-term political strategy, even if it might have some short-term appeal. So the TTIP and security, I think here in the American Security Project, you don't need any introduction to the idea that there are many models of security, European integration itself being one of them. I think the TTIP should be presented as a strengthening of the Atlantic relationship. Of course, an opportunity if the rhetoric which surrounds the launch of the TTIP negotiation is followed by action, strengthen the attractiveness and the influence in pure economic terms of the United States and the European Union together. But as Garton has said, we shouldn't fall for the everybody but China sort of idea, because by definition, as I say, in an age of interdependence, we do depend on each other. I mean, having been here for a year and listened to a lot of the sort of, what's it called, tub thumping, drum beating about the TTIP, I was amused to see the sort of rather uncertain atmosphere in which, as a result of Mr. Snowden and others, the actual talks got underway. But I think even before that, I mean, the chances of success are very, very great, but of course there's no guarantee. In the European Parliament, many speakers who support the TTIP insist that it should be a fair agreement, that the advantages shouldn't accrue too much to the US as compared with Europe, as some studies suggest. And within Europe, it must be clear that it has advantages for everybody. Of course, the European Union also has very developed structured economic relations with other countries, and they have concerns which have to be addressed. Prime Minister of Turkey was here a few weeks ago saying, hang on a minute, we've got a customs union, it's what it's going to be. Mexico, one of the leading members of the European Parliament, came into Washington for the Atlantic Week, or the Transatlantic Week last week, from Mexico, and took note of their concerns. So finally, just a word about the role of the European Parliament. As you probably know, the Parliament, since the Lisbon Treaty, has to ratify all agreements with third countries. The Parliament, shall we say, unlike the US Congress, operates with as much consensus as possible. The two largest groups, one is the centre-right European People's Party, one is the centre-left Socialists and Democrats, basically the social democratic movement in Europe, they work together. And indeed, they have to work together, because under the treaties, you have a special qualified majority to vote on important things, such as treaties with third countries. So the left have to take in the concerns of the right, and the right have to take concerns of the left into account. So issues which I know are not necessarily popular among all sectors of American opinion, issues relating to social, environment, labor rights, will have to be covered in this agreement in a way which is broadly satisfactory, not just for everything, what everybody wants, to the centre-left in Europe. And the American negotiators, I'm sure they do this already, will have to bear in mind that they're looking at a European Union which does actually work on the basis of social partnership and, of course, the involvement of civil society in the outreach here in Washington, Brussels, that is very, very good, as well as we in our office, of course, we liaise with the Congress, the various committees concerned there, but also the different interest groups, AmCham and the Business Council, all these kind of things as well, but we also reach out to the trade unions and civil society organizations with concerns about intellectual property, and I think that is in the interest of a successful agreement, rather than one little thing can hit public opinion at a certain moment and then the whole thing can unravel. Finally, a very big difference between the European Parliament and the US Congress, or another big difference, since I've hinted that the degree of consensus is a bit greater in Brussels and Strasbourg than it is down the street here. The European Parliament is very much, it's not only committed to the idea of interdependence for the member states of the European Union, that's pretty obvious, but it's also committed to the idea of openness to the rest of the world. The European Parliament is made up of parliamentarians, they're not diplomats, and they have this soft power of getting messages across on such issues as human rights, which I used to work on more intensely previously. We have a whole global matrix of established, structured parliamentary relationships, not only such as with the US Congress, the Transatlantic Legislators Dialogue, but also with the People's Republic of China, with countries of Central and Latin America. So there's only one or two. North Korea is out there on the edge. Cuba is over the edge. But most countries in the world, and even Cuba, is linked to the European Parliament via the association with the African, Caribbean, and Pacific countries. So the Parliament is open to the world. The Parliament very much supports the work of the WTO Parliamentary Assembly, which the US Congress doesn't feel necessary to take part in. So we're very open. I'm not suggesting for one second that the US Congress is more introverted, but I would say that the European Parliament is very open, and the very fact we're talking about TTIP in relation to China or Canada, Australia, Turkey, that issue will be on the agenda of direct parliamentarian to parliamentarian discussions, something I think the US Congress could almost feel left out of, because it's a pity not to be able to get your message right across at the level of the parliamentarian. So finally, as a British person, we talk about concepts of security. I've always been struck by the fact that the British Empire managed to burn down the White House in 1812 and the summer palace in Beijing in 1860. So if we look at modern concepts of security, I do take the view that Britain has a very strong interest in the European integration process rather than military means of securing their interests. So the idea of Western domination of the world clearly is sort of passé. Together, the US and the EU have to contribute to global governance and work in a way which does not allow China, which might be tempted, to follow a divide and rule approach. So finally, I would say, having said, I think this is a win-win possibility for the three main world economic powers. I think we in the EU and the US should have a little more confidence both in ourselves and in each other. I do feel in America sometimes, well, it's Europeans, it's a shambles, and I do see it in Europe sometimes, oh, America, it's hopeless, it's all just special interests. I think a little bit more mutual respect and support would be valid, and in particular, a strong leadership on both sides. I mean, the words are said, but maybe they should be said with greater conviction. I was struck by something that Hillary Clinton said in one of her goodbye, au revoir speeches, when she said that we have to, a new generation has to justify the structures which were established by a previous generation. So similarly, the European Union, to some extent, faces a generational crisis. And so if we're going to have a rebirth and a reinforcement of transatlantic relationship, it's up to contemporary leaders to get that message across as well. So thank you for your attention.
Thank you very much, Mr. Harris. As somebody who's personally had some experience with the difficulties of reaching consensus in the U.S. congressional system, but relatively little exposure to the European parliamentary system, you've certainly raised some provocative ideas and thoughts that I hope we'll have time to return to in more detail in the Q&A. But let's turn to General Cheney. In addition to being our host as the CEO of the American Security Project, you have 30 years' experience as a Marine, including serving as the Deputy Executive Secretary to two Defense Secretaries and the Chief Operating Officer for the Business Executives for National Security. So help us kind of bring this home and look at this from a security perspective. What's your view on
this? Glenn, thanks, and I want to thank Dan and Jeffrey. Jeffrey, I really want to thank you for not burning down the Marine Commandant's house. The structure they left standing here, but we appreciate that. Let me start up first saying, I am not an economist. If it wasn't for Quicken, I couldn't balance my checkbook. But I am a military guy, and I did spend 30 plus years as a Marine in a variety of jobs and billets, mostly focused on Asia, which is kind of a different perspective from our other panelists here this morning. And I got hooked into the policy business early on. You mentioned I worked with Secretary Cheney and Aspen. And following retirement, I did some work with two other guys named Curry and Hagel. And following the 2004 election, they got together and said, can we not put together a nonprofit institution that would educate on issues from a national security perspective, in particular energy security, climate security, nuclear security, American competitiveness, among others, terrorism, asymmetric operations. And now economics has come into play on the security side of the house. And a lot of people don't ordinarily associate economics with national security, but ASP feels strongly there's a big relationship here. Jeffrey, you mentioned the difficulty of obtaining consensus and getting things passed. And of course, we've seen that in our current Congress. ASP has been working the Law of the Sea Convention since its inception in 2005. The Law of the Sea Convention has been in its existence since about 1980, and we still haven't seen that one passed. And it's got support of unions, it's got oil industry, telecommunications industry, and we couldn't get that to the floor last November and December, although we could continue to try. I'm far more optimistic about TTIP, and I'll explain why here in a second. You know, it was Admiral Mullen, former chairman of Joint Chiefs, said the biggest threat to our national security is our national debt. And again, you'd say, well, why would that be? Well, if you don't have the money, you can't have your defense establishment. That's a simple equation among other things, but you lose soft power worldwide. ASP has been working now for the better part of 6 months with the Harvard Business School on American competitiveness. And it's been an interesting relationship with us. They did a couple of surveys in 2011, 2012 of all their business graduates talking about how competitive America was, not just here, but of course, worldwide. And when you look at the World Economic Forum study that they put out each year, they have a ranking, and we've dropped the United States from first to seventh between 2007 and 2012. And you might say, okay, who are the six countries that are on our top there that have moved up in front of us? And it's interesting, four of the six are from the EU. And I'll just list those four, are Finland, Sweden, Netherlands, and Germany. Right behind us is UK. The two that are not in the EU that are above us are Switzerland and Singapore. And interestingly, Japan and China aren't far behind us. So you can see America is slipping fast on the economic side of the house, certainly competitively. And we're losing power as a consequence of that, and I think our security is threatened. We put out several papers. We'll have a fact sheet out today on TTIP. And I put out an article about 2 weeks ago about 5 points relating to security and TTIP. And I'll just quickly go through my 5 points, not the least of which is studies have shown that increased international trade encourages peace among nations that are trading with each other. You have a trading relationship. You want that relationship to continue. You will foster peace. Now, some would say we're not going to war with Europe. No, we're not. However, nonetheless, you strengthen that relationship. Trade becomes a much better way of communicating than using, for instance, NATO or the military. Second, our global influence is vastly enhanced. Both my compadres here have talked about how this would be the largest trading partnership in the world, and it will be. And to me, it's kind of hard to believe that we haven't had something like this established for so long. It's way, way overdue. And thirdly, global stability has increased. And I mentioned that everybody's familiar with the Asia pivot that the administration's talked about on the military side of the house. And you can see that the economy of Asia is growing significantly. This one with Europe will enhance our relationship there much better. Now, I don't think we're doing this out of a threat to Asia or a threat to China. In fact, just the opposite. We would hope that China would join TPP, and certainly we would hope TPP gets passed as well. So it's not sitting there saying we're doing this as a threat to China. We're doing it to encourage our economic relationship with Europe, and we would certainly want to have an equivalent relationship with China. We talk about defense industrial base, and there are those in the United States who think we've cornered the market on defense industry, and that's not true. We have strong relationships with Europe. We think we can learn just as much from them on defense industry as they can from us, and so TTIP will help enhance that relationship. And finally, as mentioned by Admiral Mullen, a strong economy makes for a strong defense. If you've got something like TTIP in hand, we'll have a much better working relationship with Europe all the way around. So there's no doubt about it, there are huge security consequences for us with TTIP, and I think there are also security consequences with TPP as well, but TTIP is much farther down the line from being approved, and I think it's got a good shot at it, given the vagaries of Congress. You never know here, Jeffrey, but I think the hope, and certainly push the Snowden affair aside, I think that was a sideshow and shouldn't even be talked to in the context of TTIP. We need to get this thing going, we need to get it approved, and we're not doing it as a threat to China. So with that, I'll conclude my comments and turn it back over to you.
Thank you so much. We have about 25 minutes left, and we're going to hear questions from the audience, but let me start by asking one question of Jeffrey, if you don't mind. I'd love to hear your comments on, given your perspective, whether you think it is easier for this type of agreement to get through the U.S. congressional system over the European parliamentary system.
Well, would depend, obviously the whole way the U.S. Congress, whether they have the TPA and it's a sort of take it or leave it at the end of the negotiation, would make a big difference. So we have to watch that particular space. In the case of the European Parliament, the European Parliament, as opposed to the national parliaments, which under some scenarios would also be involved in the ratification once the negotiations are over. The name of the game is transparency during the negotiations. So every time there is a negotiation session, there are some extent confidential briefings by the main parliamentarians who are following the negotiations. And so that once the negotiations conclude, there's a confidence that the parliamentarians will be able to digest the outcome. One of the views expressed following the decision of the European Parliament not to ratify the ACTA agreement was that on that occasion the European Commission hadn't carried the members of Parliament along with it, and so when the text came up for ratification, which I believe wasn't even asked for ratification in the US, but anyway, when it came for ratification by the European Parliament, there was a grassroots campaign, very effective and timely, and that knocked the ship off the water, whatever it was. So the ACTA agreement went down. So the idea, of course, is precisely to involve parliamentarians by way of information in the negotiating process, in the same way, indeed, that the civil society might themselves be launching such a campaign later on, are invited to these outreach occasions in Washington and in Brussels. One uncertain element, or I would be optimistic, quite frankly, given the political impetus behind this. Snowden affair, yes, may go away, we'll have to see about that, but there are specific interests, audiovisual issues there hanging around, of course, but the overall advantages of a global success are clear, and that has been made clear by the overwhelming majority of members of the European Parliament. So the uncertain element comes by the fact that we live in a democratic system. America has elections all the time. The European Parliament itself has elections every 5 years, and the next election is in May of next year. And that is then followed by the choice and then the election of the President of the European Commission, Mr. Barroso, or more likely a successor, in the middle of next year, and then a 2 or 3 month process whereby the European Commission emerges and is finally sworn into office following another vote by the European Parliament, and within the European Commission there'll be most likely another Mr. De Gucht. So that can influence things, and then of course between now and then what political or economic events might take place. But certainly, so that is something that is underestimated on this side of the Atlantic. But I would say if there is a successful negotiation, it is extremely likely that the Parliament would ratify without some comings and goings remains to be seen. There's the whole issue of the sort of regulatory issues and the legislation which has to then flow from any such agreement. That could be quite tricky, but the basic idea of the TTIP has a vast consensus of support, even if, of course, there are specific interests and ideological viewpoint. So long as it emerges that it is a fair agreement and the idea doesn't get around that it's just American big business and everybody else is going to be unequally treated, then I would say be fairly optimistic about it.
Great, thank you very much. Let's open it up to the audience to ask some questions. I would ask that you please just tell us your name and your affiliation, and if your question is for anyone, any panelists in specific. Yes, sir.
We've got a microphone that's coming.
Okay. Good morning. My name is Ed Fox, and I have my own consulting business here in Washington. Your assumption this morning here about the impact of this trade agreement on our relationship with China and elsewhere is very interesting and intriguing, but it makes the assumption that the underlying agreement can actually be reached, and I'm wondering if you might help set the stage a little bit, because how are we going to deal with such things as French cultural interests? How are we going to deal with GMO grains? How are we going to get into the ag committee, the ag side, hormones and beef? How are we going to get through financial sector agreements? There's a lot of hurdles that have to be crossed before we get to discuss the benefits of having such an agreement. What is your opinion about the prospects of our political institutions being able to come together on these very big issues, which they haven't been able to solve up to this point?
Thank you. Great question. Where do things come out in the balance of whether it's more important or whether it's more difficult to get the trade? Dan, do you want to start?
Sure. I mean, your question is valid. I mean, essentially, what you've described are the central issues that are under discussion as sticking points, perhaps, but that's the nature of a trade agreement, where you've got a range of potential outcomes of how things are going, where it fails, it falls apart, and it stalls completely, similar to what has happened with the Doha round for WTO, where it's stalled. You have half a loaf, where you don't get a complete elimination of tariffs, harmonization of regulations, but you get a good amount, where reduction of tariffs for a percentage, where you have certain exemptions made for the French film industry. You have certain exemptions made for genetically modified foods being imported, some kinds yes, some kinds no, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. European airline access to the United States, and increasing of that, to a certain degree, foreign ownership of industries in the United States. But by way of example, this is something where you could get a lot of pushback from the American side. About 6 or 7 years ago, there was a big flap over a series of ports that were going to be bought by a company based out of Dubai, and there was a strong reaction, both nationally and in Congress, about the UAE having control over the port of New Jersey, New York, et cetera, et cetera. Now, that could have been a function of the politics at the time. The Iraq war was still running high, things like that. But these are concerns that everybody has in mind. And so I wouldn't characterize it as fraught with danger as much as, well, that's why the negotiations are happening. It's as if everybody feels that ultimately in the long term it's in their interest to take a hit on a particular industry because the long-term benefits are there, then they'll come to an agreement. I mean, that's the nature of any agreement. Now, you're right in saying, who can save? We'll get to that point. I'm optimistic, though, largely because the hurdles are relatively small. There's harmonization across the board from Europe and the United States fairly uniformly already. And there is admittedly an interest to have a collectivized block of economic activity because it increases the ability of all of its member states to help set terms for global trade and economic activity outside of it, specifically with China. That's my take.
General, do you want to add anything?
No, you know, Ed, it's never easy. I mean, it's complicated, and you're well familiar with it. It's a tough process. But I think on this one, you mentioned French film industry. No offense, it's a sideshow. I mean, it's a minor issue. Push it aside. There's much bigger items on the table than the French film industry. So, and I think this has been in negotiation now and been working for quite a while, that we've settled, you know, compromise is a dirty word in this town, but I think we do have compromise on this. And we at ASP are cautiously optimistic that this one's down the road pretty far, and that if you can get away from presidential politics and the partisan stuff on the Hill, eventually sell it, maybe from the national security perspective. I'm optimistic that this one's going to work here in the United States, and I think it'll work in Europe as well, because they see it to their advantage. And you sell it to the business community. All politics are local, as these two guys know. Sell it to the business guys. Show them what the in-the-pocket advantage is to the average American. That's a, as you say, it's a win-win-win, and I think it's going to work.
Parenthetically, by the way, the adoption of the elimination of barriers and harmonizing of standards, as a result, will lower the cost of manufacturing product X, right? Because you don't have to, say if you're making aspirin in Ireland, which they do, they meet European standards for safety, but they still have to be subject to FDA standards. If you can get both to sync up, then it lowers the cost of production because you don't have to go through vetting twice. As a result, it expands the market that you're that you can make your product available to, and lowers its cost, which has an ancillary effect on the rest of the planet, because the demand for raw materials increases, where you need to go do more mining of iron ore elsewhere because the demand that you've got internally has gone up. And so there's a global incentive for this to happen as well. And so not necessarily, it's not necessarily the case that you're going to have external actors be hostile to this. It means that they'll be able to sell more to the U.S. and the United States, to the U.S. and Europe.
Thanks. We have another question?
Stand you in the silence.
Yes, sir. Don't ever speak all at once.
Joshua Walker, I want to ask the bigger question. The first very small editorial comment. It's actually good that this is boring. If this was not boring, then
we've been doing our work.
So I want to point on that. It goes to the question that I just asked. How do you get people to care about this, right? It brings up GDP by 0.5%. How do you get the person in Texas to say excited about this and say, I'm going to force my congressman to vote for this? Because it's a lot easier to look at other issues around the world. How do you connect this to the local? How do you take kind of this larger discussion you're talking about TTIP and Trans-Pacific Trade Partnership and saying, look, this is good for everyone? And then also, how do you get the external actors that are not included right now, like China, Turkey, the other players that you talked about, to not be spoilers of this? So you have domestic spoilers and you have external spoilers. So we just talked about the domestic ones. How do we get domestic constituencies, and how do we get the external actors to buy into this as opposed to seeing this as a major hurdle that they want to try to
Dan, how do you get the Texan?
Well, I think the good news is that, as you said, this is dull because it's not controversial. I mean, American labor is on board with this, which is quite telling. Labor in the United States is not particularly powerful in contrast to Europe, but even they are much more favorable to this, certainly not as much as they were towards NAFTA. So I don't foresee as much resistance. You may have individual sectors of the economy. American Airlines may be concerned about the fact that Virgin Atlantic will be able to actually expand its operations in the United States, that sort of thing. But you're not getting a lot of resistance. So a lot of it will be situational. If there winds up being controversy surrounding it that starts to get the public attention to where you have to have more of an active campaign to get senatorial support to back this, I don't know. I mean, it could go in a number of directions. You could get senators saying, by doing this, it strengthens us collectively so that we can compete more capably with China, India, things like that. And so even though we may be making concessions with our European partners, it puts us in a better position globally. That may be the argument that's made. I'll speak for that half. For the American side, Jeff, if you'd like to talk about what can be done to mollify actors outside of the U.S. and Europe, like how do you make sure that this isn't considered hostile or a threat?
Well, just start with your point about it's good to be boring. I mean, if that were the case, I would say the European Parliament should be the most considered popular place in Europe, because it is considered very boring. Personally, I never found it boring at all, and I think historically, even in my lifetime, particularly obviously in the 80s and 90s, but I mean, it's been a period of one drama after the other, and a period, broadly speaking, of very successful. Many challenges at the present time, and one of them is the European self-confidence, the confidence of our citizens in the European institutions, and the institutions' confidence in themselves. So having set out on this negotiation with our main partner, the United States, obviously Europe has to has a huge interest in a success, because a failure would just contribute to this feeling, oh, it's all falling apart, and that the impetus has been lost. Of course, so the economic growth elements are very, very important. So it's a question of whether the self-confidence coupled with but avoiding a way which appears aggressive to outsiders. This concept of win-win-win for the three corners, if you like, of the world economy. So how do you mollify the external actors? I think you do it by listening to them and seeing what the real issues are. And seeing how they can be addressed. So there's the transparency of the negotiations internally with the stakeholders and the parliamentarians who will eventually have to approve the agreement, but there's also transparency and openness to outsiders and addressing the concerns. It is perfectly possible that the way things work, the people working on the TTIP haven't thought about the Mexican and the Turkish angle, they've probably thought about the Chinese, but that means that these issues have to be addressed, but they're not a reason not to advance with the whole project.
Can I wait for a second? In the fact sheet we'll have coming out today, we talk about what it does for the average American. And I'll just quote some statistics. That some estimate the trade deal would increase real per capita income by 13.4%. It would reduce unemployment by 0.73%, raise real wages by 0.93%, and result in at least $800 annually for each American family. So my point to this is, if you tell the impact on every constituent, every family, here's the advantage to you, where's the disadvantage? Why would you not want to pass this? And I think when you relate it to the average American, they'll understand it. Otherwise, yeah, it's boring. Okay, you talk about trade, economics, and all that kind of stuff. But nonetheless, you show the impact that it's gonna have on everybody sitting in this room. They'll understand it. So it's just as much a public affairs thing as it is anything else, getting the word out. A lot of people, oh God, another trade deal, we're not gonna pass a treaty. And I think Congress particularly now is treaty averse. But nonetheless, when you show what the advantage is, that's the selling point, and people will understand it, hopefully, and get it to pass.
Jeffrey, can I just, as by way of a quick follow-up, you talked about the need to seek consensus within the European Parliament, but you also mentioned they're going to elections next year with direct election of the parliamentarians. Is this something they can take to the voters? Can they package this up in a way that helps them win their re-election?
Well, I think it certainly will be among the issues mentioned in the campaign as on the table of the next European Parliament. So there may be a certain amount of taking of position, and no doubt those who are concerned with the French audiovisual issue will mention that heavily in their election campaigns. I think that the main issue for the next European elections is whether the basically pro-European strong centre within the European Parliament can maintain its leadership position. I'm fairly confident that is the case. We read about the fascists in Greece and Mrs. Le Pen in France and this kind of thing, but I think overall, even in Britain with the UKIP, whether that makes it boring, I don't know, but the end result will not transform the balance of power within the European Parliament, but I may be wrong about that. Just on this question of when you say boring, you mean not controversial in American political terms. I mean, let us be positive, since I'm encouraging a certain confidence in this project. The President of the United States, in his speech at the beginning of the year, launched the thing. The European Parliament, as it happens, our main partner is the House of Representatives, which is not controlled by the same party as the administration, and yet the leaders there seem very, Mr. Boehner included for that matter, seem well aware of the importance of the TTIP and turn up at different events, arrange meetings with visiting members of the European Parliament. So this may be one that could be kept boring because it is in the overwhelming national and transatlantic and global interest.
Thank you. I think we have time for one or two more questions. Why don't we, I'm gonna take the three questions that are over here together and then we'll ask for responses to make sure everybody gets to ask something.
Thanks very much. I'm Matthew with Atlantic Council. I've heard several of the panelists discuss how we hope China interprets these overtures and how they should know that this is not a threat, this is not a provocative arrangement, but this is eventually going to be, you know, a tide that lifts all ships. But that said, you know, if you're reading the People's Daily, you're going to be hearing some editorials and some even just straight news analysis that this is a threat. And so I was wondering if you could speak, any of the panelists could speak to, how do we address this head on? Is anyone going to try and address maybe this miscommunication head on?
Okay, thank you.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I'm Deming with Chinese embassy, so our question is actually the same with the gentleman who is asked. Today's topic is TTIP and China, so we are concerned with the negotiations between the EU and the US, because the EU is our largest trading partner and the US is the second largest trading partner. So, and you mentioned hope that the end result will be the win-win-win. And so, could you say a little bit about how negotiations, the result can end up win-win-win?
Thank you. There was one more, I think, ma'am.
Hi, good morning. My name is Tara Kirsten. I'm from Honda. All the panelists have spoken about a high level of political will to complete the negotiations, but there, as we've kind of discussed, a lot of devil in the details, particularly on the regulatory harmonization front, and making sure that, particularly in the United States, that regulators like EPA and NHTSA have significant buy-in to this process, and concerns about regulators having to cede their authority to negotiators to complete the deal. So just want to kind of get a sense of your thoughts about, beyond the political leadership, where are kind of the regulators in terms of this process?
Right. So let's do this. Let's go in reverse order from how we started. So I'll give Dan the last word.
Oh,
and we got about 5 minutes, so I'll ask you for just a couple of minutes. Bring us home, wrap it up, and sort of respond to the notion of how do we both at the low level go from the politics to connecting with the regulators and getting that level involved, and to the higher level with how does the United States and the European Union approach China to in a little more direct way to penetrate the notion of that win-win-win? General?
Well, let me start with China first. And I mentioned the impact on the average American of this, and the advantage it would have to the average American. Wouldn't it be nice to have a similar arrangement with Asia, or with the TPP, or with China, and increase our money that much more? So I don't think any of this is aimed at China specifically at all, frankly. We didn't go into this negotiation saying, hey, we need to counter China's influence in the world, and not in the least. And I mentioned working with China. I talked about Asia Pivot a second ago. What you're seeing now, of course, and this is a little bit off the subject, but the U.S. military is starting to work again much closer with the Chinese military, and get, it has a much better working relationship, and there's a lot going on there. So to answer your question, I don't view it as a threat. In fact, I would do it the other way around. That would hopefully encourage China to enter agreements that are similar and help us encourage trade between us and China. I can't speak to the regulatory side, so I'll leave that to yourself. And on the win-win-win, I do think it's a win-win-win, and I think the better economic relationships we have with Europe, the better off we're going to be, and if we have better economic relationships with Asia, the better off we'll be there.
Thank you. Jeffrey?
Well, I know that in the United States, I come across a skepticism, the European parliamentarians, and even the national parliament of the EU comes across this from time to time. The MEPs, they have the right to travel all over the place. Where are they this week? Okay, it's a fair question. But if there's a miscommunication, then it means there has to be communication. In my opinion, the Congress of the US could consider doing exactly what the European Parliament does, which is establishing a direct working relationship with the People's National Congress, where I can assure you human rights issues as well as trade and economic issues are on the agenda at the meetings, which take place twice a year. Then they could go further, as the European Parliament has done, send delegations of members of the Committee on Internal Market and Consumer Affairs or the International Trade Committee to go and meet with the authorities in China and express their views directly, as the Chinese authorities know. Having a visit, had a nice look around, and a friendly reception doesn't make one blind, doesn't make the members of Parliament blind to the difference of interests and indeed the differences with regard to the human rights and the functioning of the political system, but at least assures that there is a genuine line of communication. I would say, imagine pushing that idea past Mr. Maynard's office. The members of the House of Representatives should be allowed to have two meetings a year with the Chinese. But I mean, if there is a miscommunication, then these arguments should be dealt with directly. As I say, China clearly has a different political system. We have a great deal of confidence, whatever confidence we have in EU and TTIP, we do have a confidence in our democratic system. China is governed, shall we say, in a somewhat different way, and we can only speculate as to how that will develop. One does note these editorials and articles in different newspapers in China, which are primarily for domestic consumption, but all negotiators tend to start off by big threats, and so maybe one shouldn't overestimate that, because historically China has supported the process of European integration, and objectively, since this is a jobs and growth agreement, it is by definition therefore a contribution to a stronger world economy, with China particularly in the present phase of its economic growth has a very great interest. So without being naively optimistic, ignoring all the special interests which come up in the EU as well, our way of dealing with the issues is democracy, isn't it? It's debating the things out in the open. Every NGO can circulate the whole of the European Parliament or the US Congress, and we're prepared to let that process unfold precisely because we're confident that a global understanding can be reached between the two main partners. In this case, China manages its political system somewhat differently.
Well, the three questions asked effectively were one question about regulatory standards or buy-in, and then the other two questions were the same question but from different perspectives. So as far as regulatory buy-in is concerned, from all that I have observed so far, regulatory agencies that have a stake in the United States in this trade process so far are generally very supportive, but keeping a watchful eye on how things are proceeding. The lead negotiator on the behalf of the United States is the USTR. The advantage of having a federalized system is those agencies that are under direct federal presidential control, the instructions are to be supportive. There are some independent ones that may have their own voices, but generally speaking, I don't foresee a great deal of resistance, if only because the regimes in each of the countries in Europe that match up against the United States are fairly similar to begin with. It's just that this will be harmonization at a larger, at a higher scale. And then it sort of is a circular argument, but if there are disagreements, that's what the negotiations are for, to hammer out the differences. I can't speak to it from the European perspective, but I suspect they're coming at it with the same attitude. Separately, for the question of the gentleman from the Atlantic Council about how do we address this directly to China or other potential state actors outside of the process, and from the gentleman from the Chinese embassy is how is this a win-win for China? Well, first is to communicate the fact that this is not hostile activity. Countries having relaxed trade and regulatory systems don't necessarily do what they can to increase in security. And if this means that it increases competitiveness between this block of Europe and the United States and China, that's not necessarily hostile, any more so than trade between Germany and Australia is. You may have competition, and it can be sharp-elbowed, but it isn't of ill intent between the two. And that is a distinction to be made. And then secondly, there is an effect in that, from the Chinese perspective, having a unified regime simplifies things for Chinese exports, because now you have a place that you can sell your products where you only have to obey one set of rules, and that will decrease costs for production. And so there is an advantage from the Chinese perspective to this as well. And to pivot off of something that Jeff had talked about, the Chinese economy right now is reaching a point where it is maturing into a second stage of an industrialized advanced economy, to where it's becoming a consumer market. And one of the biggest challenges that any advanced economy faces is standards, where you have consumers that have more and more purchasing power. They expect to have the products they consume, the services they consume, meet a certain threshold, and to make sure that there is legal underpinning to make sure that, you know, the food that you buy is going to be safe, that the baby milk that you buy is going to be safe, that sort of thing. If you are manufacturing products for sale to the foreign markets that have to meet these standards, it has the ancillary effect of having these products be made available for the Chinese market that can also meet those standards as well. So it's to the benefit of the Chinese consumer. That would be my take. It's less direct, but it is positive.
Thank you. So one of the most difficult parts of the moderator job is to bring a very interesting discussion to a close on time. So I'm gonna do that now by thanking again General Cheney and your staff here at ASP for hosting us today, and all of our panelists for some very thought-provoking remarks. Thank you.
Thank you.